When I was in first grade, I remember one day very particularly because my teacher came to me and said, you're not going to have lunch with the class today. Your dad's going to pick you up. I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. And my dad had made the choice to drop whatever he was doing with work and to come and pick me up, this snot-nosed first grader, and take me to McDonald's for lunch. Just out of the blue, this, you know, hey, let's just take you out of school and go to lunch. I don't know if my mom knew he did that or not, but he did. And that memory sticks with me. I mean, this is, you know, 40 years later almost. Yeah, about 40 years or so. And I still remember that. You know, of all my memories from being a kid, I remember that moment that my dad chose to come and pull me out of class and take me to McDonald's and just have a meal with me in a special way. And that was a great choice because it stayed, the small little thing. And today, I want to talk about the great choices that good fathers make. I want us to think about the choices that good fathers make. And I want to think about that by telling you the story of a man named Mordecai. Most of you know it as the story of Esther, but I'm going to tell you the story of Mordecai. If you remember, recently we did a series on Daniel, and we talked about how Daniel and several other young men were taken captive when Babylon conquered Israel. And the way the Babylonians did it was genius. They would come in, they'd conquer a nation, they'd defeat them in battle, and then they would take their best and their brightest. They'd take all the children from all the wealthy families and all the smartest people, the most talented people, and they would carry them off back to their own capital city, and they would then train them up to serve in their own court so that they had the best of everything in their city. And Mordecai was one of the people who was carried off with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and all those people we were talking about back then. By the time we get to our story today with Mordecai, though, a lot of time has passed. The Babylonians have been conquered now by the Persians, and King Xerxes is now the king, and the capital city is called Susa. And Mordecai lives there in Susa, and he spends his days at the king's gate. The king's gate is where all the business of the kingdom is conducted. It's where disputes are settled and where all the information is broadcast to the kingdom. So Mordecai had some kind of place here, sitting at the king's gate, being relied on to participate in the business of the kingdom. And that's the first thing we learn about Mordecai, is that he was carried off with the original people who were taken out of Israel, out of Jerusalem, and dragged off here to this new place, the city of Susa. The second thing we learn about him is that he had a young cousin named Esther. And for some reason, when Esther was just a little girl, she lost her mom and dad. We don't know why. We only know that Mordecai chose to take his young little cousin and raise her as though she were his own daughter. That's the second thing that we learn about Mordecai. He chose to be Esther's father. And I want to pause there, because as we go through this story, what I'm going to try and do is just call out the choices that good fathers make. And the very first one, good fathers choose to be fathers. Good fathers continually choose to be fathers. Because choosing to be a father is not about one night with a mother. Every father has to make a decision every day, every hour, every minute, constantly make a decision to provide and to teach and support and care for their children. Good fathers make the choice to be a father constantly. I don't know how many of you know who Ernie Johnson is. He's a commentator in Major League Baseball and for the NBA. He's one of the main guys. When the NBA is having finals, they go to the place with Shaquille O'Neal and Charles Barkley, and there's this one weird-looking guy with a bow tie sitting in the middle of the table usually. That's Ernie Johnson. Ernie Johnson's wife, Cheryl, was overseas one day and visiting an orphanage, and she called home and was talking to Ernie about this three-year-old boy named Michael that she met there. And Michael couldn't speak. He had a club foot. And over the phone, she just happened to say to Ernie, I wonder what's going to happen to this boy. I'm so curious what his future will be if he's left here and no one takes him. And Ernie just said, well, I'll tell you what, let's bring him home and let's find out what his future is going to be. Let's make his future. And so they adopted that little boy, Michael, and brought him home. He was later diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, and now he's 26 years old. And he's attached to a ventilator, has to use a wheelchair. But through all this care, which has been, you can imagine, expensive and extensive, all kinds of things they've had to do, Ernie and Cheryl have not at any point shrunk away from the challenges of parenting this young man. And they've adopted others too. They continually choose to be a father because they also have two children of their own and then three that they've adopted, including Michael, besides Michael. So Ernie, this is what Ernie says about this. He says, some people, they're driven by going on mission trips or digging wells for kids who don't have water. Everybody's wired differently. This is one of the ways we're wired. We have this heart for adoption. It's rooted in our faith, our Christian faith. We're instructed to care for the orphans and the widows. We don't want credit. We don't want pats on the back. We're getting a heck of a lot more out of it than they are. Good fathers come in all kinds of varieties, right? Whether you're an adoptive father, a stepfather, a birth father, a natural father. Good fathers continually choose to be fathers. And don't take for even a minute, don't take for granted the difficulty of that choice. In a world where fatherhood and motherhood are thrown away like an infected appendix, don't undervalue how difficult it is to choose to be a father continually, constantly. And fathers make that choice every day, constantly, consciously. Don't take it for granted. Don't take it lightly. You're not a good father by sharing your DNA. You're a good father by sharing your life. Good fathers constantly choose to be fathers. And what we're going to discover with Mordecai is that he didn't just choose to be a father to Esther when she was young and cute, right? He was a father to her all through her life, even when things got really difficult and they're about to get really difficult for her. Even after, spoiler alert, she married King Xerxes, that's going to happen. Even then, he continued to father her. And some of you know this story, you've heard it 1,000 times. Some of you have never heard the story before. Those of you who've heard it 1,000 times, listen to it from Mordecai's perspective and think of fatherhood here, right? Those of you who've never heard it before, try and just ingest this whole story as we share it this morning and then go home and read it again and again because it is an amazing story. So leading up to all this, you get to the book of Esther and it begins with this party that lasts for 6 months. King Xerxes is very happy because he's rich. He's rich because he owns all these people. His kingdom spreads from India all the way to Ethiopia, and it would expand beyond that even more. And so he's taxing all these people, and he throws this party, this lavish party, for all of his leaders from all of his provinces. They all come, and they eat like pigs for 6 months, and they revel, and they drink for 6 months. And you wonder, how would they pay for that? Well, they paid for that because of taxing all these other nations like Israel, like Jerusalem, where they're in poverty because of King Xerxes and all he's taken from them. For 6 months, he throws this drunken party, and at one point in the party, he summons for his wife, Queen, who remembers her name? Vashti, thank you. I forgot it for a second. Calls for her to come and wants her to dance for everybody. Now, he wanted her to basically strip tease in front of all of his friends. And she said, what would you all say if your husband asked you to do that? No, don't throw the other words you'd say in there. Just no, leave it there. No, not doing that. She said no. And so he got rid of her. He didn't kill her. He got rid of her because they said, look, we can't let this happen. If she doesn't listen to you, then none of our wives are going to listen to us. It's a bad precedent. We got to fix this. And so he puts her out. Kicks her out. A few months later, though, he gets lonely and realizes once he sobers up, that was a dumb thing to do. She was a lovely queen. And now he needs a new queen. And his really smart advisors come to him and they come up with an idea. And they say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to send out people to all the provinces, right? From India all the way to Ethiopia. And we're going to have them pick the most beautiful virgins in all of these countries, all these nations. And we're going to bring them all here. We're going to spend a year with them, cleaning them and teaching them how to act. And it's going to be, you know, perfumes and oils. And it's going to take a year of prepping them. And then once they're ready, we'll send one into you every night. And you get to sleep with them. And then you pick the one you like the most. which to Xerxes, of course, sounds like a great idea, but imagine if you're one of those young girls. How does it sound to you? Imagine if you're the father of one of those young girls. What would you do if your daughter was chosen to go and be part of the king's harem and potentially become his queen if she goes through this process and auditions for him this way? What would you do? The truth is, there isn't much you could do. There was not much Mordecai could do. He had no say. He had no power here. One of the myths of our world is that it's possible for fathers to save the day, to protect their children from the world and the harshness of it, that you can shelter them and no harm will ever come to them. That's one of the myths of our world that makes fathering honestly impossible, that you can shield your child from any bad or uncomfortable thing ever happening. You can't. Your job as a father is not to protect your children from the difficulties of life. It's to prepare them for them. Good fathers choose to prepare their children to handle life's difficulties. They do that by teaching them not to run away or melt or wilt because they're not getting what they think they deserve or ought to have. They do it by building character into their children. Mordecai prepared Esther for this by building character into her life, by teaching her how to follow God and honor God, teaching her how to trust God, and also telling her, look, when they take you in, don't tell them you're a Jew because things will not go well for you if they know you're a Jew, because the Jewish people were not well-liked in Susa. We'll see why a little bit later. So Esther keeps that to herself, and over the year of preparation in that harem as she's being given all the beauty treatments, she distinguishes herself by her character. All the women there are beautiful. Right? All of them are gorgeous women brought together. What sets Esther apart is not that she's pretty, although that sets her apart, but she's with a whole bunch of pretty women. What sets her apart is her character, the way she behaves there, the way she acts, her humility, her grace. She stands out because of those things, her wisdom. And when the time comes for her to meet the king, he loves her more than any of the other women, chooses her to be his wife, makes her his queen, and he loves her so much, imagine this, that he gives back taxes to all the provinces for the year. Just take back all the money. Imagine a king doing that. That's how head over heels he is. That's how happy he is that he's found Esther and she's his wife. Where did Esther learn that character? Where did she learn the ability to go through that, being taken from her life, forced into this life, forced to go into the king? Where did she learn the character that would enable her to stand in the midst of all that and actually make the best of it? She learned it, the story tells us, by following Mordecai's lead from the time she was a little girl all through her life. She caught from him the values and character that guided her. Good fathers choose to build character into their children, not to try and protect them from life, but to prepare them for life. They build character into their children. They prepare them to deal with the troubles of life. Not to expect life to be easy and simple because daddy's always there to save you. He's not. He can't be. They build character into their children so their children won't crumble under pressure. And you'd be surprised how easy that can be, really. It can be done in small ways. Taking time to take your son out or your daughter out. Tony Dungy is a football coach. Most people here don't like him because he used to coach the rival of the Patriots. But he is, by all accounts, just a wonderful, loving man. He's got a family where he's got 3 children with his wife, and they've adopted 7 others. And he tells this story about going fishing with his dad. He said his dad used to like to take him and his brother, younger brother, fishing. And he remembered a time when they were out there, and the dad was teaching them how to cast on their own. And his 5-year-old brother and he were sitting there, and they just kept practicing casting, and no one's talking because you're fishing. You're not supposed to talk. And they just keep casting and casting, and it's dead quiet. And all of a sudden, he just says, guys, just hold still for a minute. Don't move. And he looks back, and he sees his dad kind of just reaching for the side of his head. And then he hears his dad say to his brother, now, Lyndon, I want you to listen. You always need to make sure that you know not only where your pole is when you're going to cast, but also where everyone else is when you're casting. And he realized what his dad was doing while he was just calmly talking to his brother is he was removing a fish hook from his ear because his little brother had hooked his dad's ear while he was casting. And he said a few years later, he was taking his own children fishing and he got hooked in the hand and he realized how much that hurts. That stings and it kills. And he, trying to get that out, he remembered how much pain, and he thought back to his dad constantly saying, okay, Lyndon, don't move, after he got hooked in the ear. What would your dad say if you hooked him in the ear while you were fishing? Or dads, what would you say if you had a hook go through your ear because you're a kid, right? But he said, that day I learned more than just how to cast a hook. I learned patience from my dad. Incredible patience. Character can be taught in such simple ways. Good fathers choose to build character in their children, and they do it by modeling it. They model it for their children. So Mordecai modeled it for Esther. She becomes the queen. But in that process, something else had happened. Mordecai, sitting at the gate, was privy to all kinds of goings on, and he heard these two guys who were angry plotting to kill the king. And so Mordecai had, what do I do with this information? If they kill the king, then maybe Esther wouldn't have to go through this, right? He goes and he tells Esther about the plot. He says, there's a couple guys, I've heard them talking, they're plotting to kill the king. He gives her the information. Then she goes and she tells the king, there's a couple guys, here are their names, they're plotting to kill you, king. Mordecai told me, and the king investigates, finds out, and deals with it the way they dealt with that. They killed him and hung their bodies from a pole so everyone would see. This is what happens when you go against the king. But notice what he did there. Mordecai could have taken that information and gone in and said, king, I found something out you're going to want to know, and promoted himself. Instead, he gave that information to Esther, preparing her to succeed. Good fathers prepare their children to succeed. They don't give them all the answers. They give them what they need, and so that their children can then take it and learn and use it the right way. Good fathers do things that put their children in a place to succeed. Mordecai didn't go for the credit. He didn't go to make himself be known. He gave it to Esther so she could choose to use it wisely. He didn't do everything for her. He set her up. And you can see that she learned about it from him, because she, in the process, made sure that he got credit. She made sure they wrote his name down when they recorded the whole thing, that Mordecai was the one who told her about these two guys that were going to kill the king. And so when they wrote down the report, that went in there. Good fathers give their children what they need so they can succeed. They set them up for success. Well, then the whole story for Mordecai is about to take a dark turn, because King Xerxes appoints this guy named Haman to be second in charge over the whole kingdom. And what that means is now Haman gets to make decisions. He gets to wear the ring that makes decisions. And wherever he goes, the king gives a command. Everyone is now supposed to bow to him the way they bow to the king, as a show of honor and respect to Haman. Mordecai, being a Jew, refused to bow to Haman, who was a descendant of a group of people who were horrible to the Jewish people too. So that didn't make it any easier. And this is one of the things that always made it difficult for the Jews in exile. They were never quite like everyone else. They didn't assimilate or blend in. They kept God's laws. They tried to be faithful to God. And so they didn't go along with what everyone else did. They didn't blend. And so Mordecai refuses to bow down. And Haman, as he's riding through the king's gate, sees everyone bowing and notices that Mordecai is just standing there. And it infuriates Haman. But Haman knows, this isn't just a Mordecai problem. This is a Jewish people problem. All of them are troublemakers. And so what he decides to do is not just kill Mordecai. He decides, you know what? We need to just kill all the Jewish people in the whole kingdom, in the whole empire. We need to just wipe out all the Jewish people in the world. He plans a genocide of the Jewish people. And so he goes to King Xerxes and tells him, you know, king, there's a group of people scattered throughout your kingdoms and provinces that don't follow your laws, that don't go along with all of us who are trying to enforce your laws and your culture and what you want done here. And we really, they won't go along. The best thing we can do, we need to wipe them out. And I'll tell you what, I'll pay for the whole project. Just let me do it. I'll take care of it and get rid of them for you. And King Xerxes says, that sounds like a great idea. Thank you. Go ahead and do it. So they pick a day, 12 months later, and they write up a memo and send it to all the provinces from India to Ethiopia, saying everywhere to everyone that on this particular day, you are free, and actually you're commanded to go kill all the Jews who are around you. If you have a neighbor who's a Jew, on that day, you can go and kill him and kill his family, kill his wife, kill his children, and take all his stuff. And they sent that out to all the provinces, everywhere. And of course, you can imagine what happened. It caused chaos. Haman and King Xerxes, they sit back to have a beer at the end of making this decision. But the story tells us the whole city of Susa's in an uproar because of all this fear and dread of what's going to happen. Mordecai rips his clothes and puts on a sack and throws ashes on his head to just show how distressed he is. And he begins to walk through the city of Susa, the capital city, and just screaming and wailing, crying out of grief. And he walks all the way up to the king's gate and stops there. And he's just sitting there wailing in grief and in protest and in sorrow for what's going on. And word gets back to Esther that Mordecai is out there dressed in a sack and covered in ash, just screaming and wailing. And she doesn't know what's happened. So she sends a messenger and says, go find out what happened. What's going on with them? Tell them to get up and give them these clothes to put on. So the messenger goes and tells Mordecai, what's wrong? Here, change, clean up. And he's like, no, I won't do it. Because Haman and the king have made this memo that they've sent everywhere that saying that they're going to kill all the Jews here. And he gives them a copy of it to bring back to Esther. And then he gives them also this command to give to Esther. He says to Esther, you must go into the king and plead for the lives of your people. So the servant goes back and tells Esther all this. And she sends word back to Mordecai and says, I can't go into the king. It's illegal to go into the king. If I go into the king and he hasn't called me, they'll kill me. They'll cut off my head. No one can just go into the king. You have to get permission. And if anyone shows up, here's what happens. Either they kill you, most likely, or the king smiles and holds his scepter out to you and then you're allowed to come. But no one's done this. And the king hasn't called for me in a month. So she sends that message to Mordecai. I want to show you what Mordecai says, because I want you to think about what would you say if you're her dad in that moment? What advice would you give your daughter? Do you just settle for the idea that, you know what, she's the queen, maybe she'll be protected and that's enough for me, my daughter will survive. Because she's the queen, she's in the palace, they don't know she's a Jew, she'll be okay. Do you just settle for that? What do you say to her? This is what Mordecai said. I'll show it to you here. He told her, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Whether you've come to this place, this moment where you are, for such a time as this. Maybe this is why this has happened. Good fathers choose to challenge their children to live for a purpose that is beyond themselves. Good fathers challenge their children to live for God and God's people. What kind of life are you giving your children? A life of safety, security, comfort, a life where comfort and quiet is the goal? Or are you choosing to challenge your children to live a life of significance, a life of purpose? Researchers are discovering more and more that what's making the younger generation seem so aimless, and in particular young men, seem so aimless, is that no one has taught them about carrying responsibility. Everyone's taught them about what their rights are, but no one's taught them about carrying difficult responsibility or modeled that for them. Standing up and carrying things on their shoulders. And so everyone's trying to figure out their place in this world. Everyone's trying to get to a good place. And they've got this idea that I should just arrive at a place and be on top, like that's all that matters, when that's not what matters. Getting to a place and a position in the world isn't what matters. What you do with the place and position you're in is what matters. Mordecai reminds Esther there is a purpose to her place. She is not significant because she's the queen. She's not significant because she's beautiful. She will be significant when she uses the place she is in and the gifts God has given her to do something that's beyond herself, to serve God and serve God's people and his purpose that's much larger than just herself. Good fathers choose to challenge their children to live a life of significance, to live for purpose, for God's purpose. So listen to Esther's response. She sends back a note to Mordecai and says, go, Gather all the Jews that you can find in the city, in Susa. Hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my young woman here will do that as well. Then I'm going to go to the king, though it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. You know, there are these moments, fathers, where you know that your good choices are paying off and that it's working and making a difference. And this is one of those moments for Mordecai. To watch Esther struggle with this and then make this decision, this courageous decision, to go and put her life on the line. Mordecai knows that she has grown up now. And to watch her not only do that, but lean on God and call on him to go and call others to fast and pray for her, to see her courage, to see her willingness to serve God, to see her leaning on God's strength and willingness to put it all on the line. On the one hand, must have been terrifying for Mordecai, and on the other hand, more deeply satisfying than anything he'd ever experienced before. And don't miss the last line, go back to that last verse, verse 17, where it says, the scene started with what? Mordecai sending a command to Esther, you must go and tell the king to spare your people. It ends with Esther sending a command to Mordecai, and Mordecai going away obeying everything Esther had ordered him. I think that's just a really interesting twist. Good fathers choose to pray for their children. But then another thing good fathers choose to do is they choose to acknowledge their children's growth with respect. They acknowledge their children's growth with respect. I know that's not easy, you know, but she'll always be my baby. Yeah, good luck changing the diapers when she's a 40-year-old baby. That's not what you want. You don't want her to always be your baby. You don't want him to always be your baby. You want them to become a godly woman, a godly man, who even begin to lead you with some of the things they do. That's how you know you've parented well, you've fathered well, when your children begin to also now lead the way with the character you've instilled in them and taking it beyond you even. That's how you know. Good fathers pray and fast for their children, that they choose to do that, but they also choose to acknowledge their children's growth with respect. So she goes in to the king a few days later after praying, and she puts on her finest, you know, queen gown and walks into the throne room, and there's the king and all his attendants there. And she stands there, and the king is sitting on his throne, and he looks up and sees her, and this is the moment. He's either going to look at his attendant and someone's going to cut her head off, or what? He picks up his head, he notices her, and this big smile goes across his face, and he reaches out to her and tells her, come here, I've missed you. Tell me what you want, anything you want. I'll give you up to half of everything I own. Just tell me what you want. And so she walks up to him, and she tells him, here's all I ask right now. It's just simply this. Please, would you come to a feast that I'm preparing for you and for your second-in-command, Haman? Just come to the feast. That's all I ask right now. And so the king calls for Haman, and they go to this feast that Esther prepared for them, and they sit down, and they're eating and drinking wine. And he says to Esther, Esther, please, my queen, tell me what it is you would like me to do for you, and I'll do whatever it is you ask. And she says, well, if it pleases the king, I would like you to come back tomorrow for another feast and bring Haman again as well. And let's do another feast tomorrow. So they go and they leave, and she begins to get a feast ready for the next day. And Haman walks out of that day, out of the palace, on cloud nine. No one else, none of the other leaders, no one has ever been brought in to this kind of intimate, special dinner with the king and his queen. No one ever gets that treatment. He must be special. They're grooming him for something. Maybe they're going to divide the kingdom and make him king over another part. Who knows? But it seems like they're grooming him for great things. And as he's walking out of the palace and gets to the king's gate, everyone bows except Mordecai. Standing there, looking at him, not bowing. And Haman just begins to shake with anger. He forgets all the great things that are happening in his life, and he goes home, and he's just seething, and his wife's like, what's wrong? Was it bad, the meal? Was it? And he's like, no, that was wonderful. But this Mordecai, she's like, but look, your job is amazing. Look, you're valued by the king and the queen. You've got 10 wonderful sons and a beautiful wife. Look, you know, look at the home you have. Why are you upset about this one jerk, Mordecai? Forget about him. But Haman couldn't do that. He spent his night, instead of playing with his 10 sons, he spent the night building a 75-foot pole that he planned to hang Mordecai's dead body from. And so that night, he didn't kiss his children goodbye. He lay there on his bed. Good night. He lay there on his bed imagining, first thing in the morning, I'm going to get up. I'm going to go ask the king, can I kill Mordecai? He's the chief of all the people giving you problems. Let me not wait until the end of the year. Let me kill Mordecai. I'll go. I'll ask him. He'll say yes. I'll kill him. I'll hang him from the pole. Everyone will know. It'll be great. I don't have to worry about him not bowing to me anymore. That's how he drifted off into sleep. But that night, the king had trouble sleeping. He lay there in bed and couldn't get to sleep, and so he turned on the History Channel. They didn't have a TV. So for them, the History Channel was, he made someone else wake up and come in and read to him just the stories of things that had happened in the kingdom. And all night long, they were reading the stories, and just as day was breaking, they got to the story of how these two guys were plotting to kill the king during the time when he was, you know, looking for a new queen, and how Queen Esther had come in and told them about it, but that the source of the information had been this man, Mordecai, who serves at the king's gate. And King Xerxes said, wait a minute, did we ever do anything for Mordecai? I was so caught up with Esther, I forgot about Mordecai. And they told him, no, we didn't do anything for Mordecai. So he said, huh, are any of my officials awake yet? Are anybody here in the court? And they said, well, Haman's here. Haman got there before sunup because he was just so desperate to get Mordecai. So he's like, ready, I'm going to ask the king. Here's what I'm going to ask him. Here's what I'm going to say. He was there early to ask for Mordecai's head. And so they call Haman in, and Haman goes into the king, and the king says to him, Haman, what do you think the king should do for the person he wants to honor highly above everyone else? And Haman assumes he must be talking about him. That's why they had the lunch yesterday. That's why they're going to have another banquet today, another feast today. He must be talking about him. So Haman lays it on thick. It's like if your parent brought you in and said, what do you want for Christmas? And you tell them this, you know, anything at all, name it. And you name this great list of toys, and then they give it to your brother. Right? So he begins to name, well, you should give him one of your royal robes to wear, and you should give him your horse to ride and a crown to wear, and you should make one of your leading officials walk him around the city saying, this is someone the king wants to honor. This is what happens to those who the king is pleased with. And he just lays it on thick, all these things to be done for the person the king wants to honor. And when he's done, the king says, I love the way you think. Everything you said is great. I want you to do every single one of those things for Mordecai. Don't leave anything out. When the morning was over and Haman was done leading Mordecai around the city, yelling out, this guy's awesome, this guy's great, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, and Haman went home just shaking with anger. He actually says he like covered his head, like he put his hood on and walked home. You could just see the bitterness and hatred in his heart. And he gets home and he's yelling and screaming and is telling his wife what happened, ignoring everything going on with his kids, ignoring everything else. This is all that matters to him. And while he's complaining, they come and they tell him, hey, it's time for Queen Esther's feast. And he's like, oh, great, the king's going to ask me about the morning. So he goes to the feast. He's happy that he's got this special feast he gets to go to, but he's worried that the king's going to say, how did it go with Mordecai? And he's going to have to pretend he was happy. But the king doesn't ask him that. The king's too concerned with whatever it is that Esther's going to want. So he gets there, they sit down, they start to eat, and the king can't even wait for the food. He's like, Esther, tell me what it is you want. Anything, anything, half of everything I own, I'll give it to you. Just tell me what your heart's desire is. And Esther tells him, my wish is that you would give me my life, and my desire, my request is that you would give me the life of my people and spare my people, because someone is plotting to sell us into death. Someone is planning to kill us and destroy us and wipe us off the planet. And the king is shocked, and he says, who could do such a thing? Who would dare do such a thing? And Esther points at Haman and says, an enemy. This man, this wicked Haman. The king was so angry, he he stormed out of the room into the garden to just compose himself for a minute and think about, how am I going to kill this guy? And as he's out there, Haman starts to beg Esther for his life, and he's just like grabbing at her, and she's lying there on the couch. They would lie down and eat. And he's like, please, please, you've got to save me. And as King Xerxes walks back in, he's falling on top of her. That didn't help. So now the king is through the roof, and he's ready to kill him. And then this other attendant standing over here says, by the way, king, I don't know if it's pertinent, but I noticed Haman last night built a 75-foot pole in his yard, and he was planning to kill that guy Mordecai who saved your life. He wanted to kill him and hang him from it today. I don't know if that's pertinent, but you maybe should know that too. And so they killed Haman horribly, and they hung his dead body from that pole. In the end, there's still a big problem, right? There's the day coming when the Jews are going to be attacked. And according to the laws of the Medes and Persians, you can't change a law. Remember that happened with Daniel and the lions then? They couldn't change the law, so Daniel had to go in, even though the king didn't want him to have to do it. So the king can't change that law, but he made a new law. He said, on this day when all the people have been given permission to attack any Jews they know, there's a new law. All the Jews are allowed to gather and defend themselves. And so effectively what it did is people throughout the whole empire began converting to Judaism for fear of what would happen on that day. And on that day, the Jews were able to overthrow their enemies and anybody who tried to attack them. They became more wealthy than they'd ever been. This was God prospering them in the middle of exile. They're far from home, but God is taking care of them, right, through all of this. And sadly, Haman's 10 sons didn't learn from their dad's mistakes and bad choices. They went out that day to attack the Jews, and so every one of them ended up killed, and every one of Haman's 10 sons' dead bodies ended up hanging from that 75-foot pole that Haman had built to display Mordecai's dead body. You see, when one bad choice fathers make sometimes is when they take the good things they have for granted out of an obsession and a desire for something else, and they pass on to their children hatred and bigotry and rage. And the ripple effect of that lasts for generations. Our choices ripple for generations. But the story of Mordecai and Esther is so amazing for the good choices, though, that Mordecai, as a good father, made. A choice to be a father, constantly choosing to be a father. The choice to build character into her life instead of trying to always shelter her from anything. The choice to equip her with opportunity to succeed, right? And the choice to challenge her to live a life of significance, not just of comfort and safety, to live for something beyond herself. The choice to pray for her. The choice to respect her when she demonstrated maturity. All these choices that he made are beautiful choices. And I encourage you to go, and if you've never heard this story or read this whole story, go home and read this story. Because in the end, behind the story of Mordecai and Esther and his good choices of, as a father, is God as a father to Israel, caring for her. God chose to adopt Israel. And here she is in this foreign land. Because of her disobedience and sin, God is disciplining her. He's teaching her and building character. God is a good father behind this story as well. There are three father stories about God in Scripture, at least, when you look. The original one is when God chose to be the father of humanity, of creation, when he chose to create us. That was God choosing to be a father, choosing to bring us into life, and continually choosing to sustain our life. God is continually choosing to be our father, sustaining our lives. And he chose to give us the ability to choose, to demonstrate character and to choose to live lives of significance by obeying him. And that's led to a messy world where we choose to not obey him and live for ourselves instead of for him. And he doesn't pluck us out of that and just, oh no, let me make your life easier. He equips us to walk through this world and live for purpose and meaning. God's the first father relationship is God as creator. But then there's the second father relationship God has when he adopts Israel to be his nation, his daughter, right? He chose Israel. He adopted her because he wanted the world to see, the world that was rejecting God as Father and rebelling against him as Father. He wanted them to see, look at all the blessings and beauty when I am your Father. And he wanted them to see that in Israel. Unfortunately, Israel rejected God as Father too. And that leads us to God looking for a way to bring us back to him and reconcile us to him. And that's the third father relationship God has with us, where he sends his one and only son, Jesus. Jesus chose to put his life on the line for the purpose of reconciling us to God and bringing glory to God by reconciling us to him as our Father. In Jesus, fathers, in Jesus, we see God demonstrating that he is a good, good father. We see his actions and the choices of a good, good father. And as your relationship with God grows, as you recognize what Jesus did and who he is, and you recognize what God has been doing from the beginning and the choices he has made to sustain us, to grow us, to build into us character, to develop us, and you see, to sacrifice for us, to put himself on the line for us, that shows you what a father does. That teaches you. And look, fathers, you will fail at times. You will mess up. There'll be times when you don't choose to be a father, times when you don't choose to build character into your children. There'll be times when you instead overprotect your children, right? There'll be times when you mess up in all kinds of ways, but don't quit because we need fathers. We need our fathers. Our world needs fathers. There is a shortage of good fathers in the world. We need all the godly fathers we can get. And those of you who have fathers, how many of you have fathers? All right, that's just an attention checker right there. You all have fathers, right? Honor them. Acknowledge them. We live in a world that is tearing fatherhood apart. It's a shame that, you know, I feel it every time I talk about, you know, father or father imagery. It seems at least half of the people you talk to imagine someone who is abusive, neglectful, hate-filled, addicted. This image of fathers has been painted focusing on that, those who failed. And then there's pictures that our culture gives us, fathers as goofballs, adults who need to be told everything to do, who the children shouldn't listen to because mom really knows what's going on, right? There's these stories, that these myths that we spread around in our culture. Reject all of that stuff, put it aside, and look at God as Father and honor fathers. Honor fathers. What they do is not easy. What they're called to be is not easy. The sacrifice they're called to make, the choices they're called to make are not easy. And so we want to honor them. So this morning, we want to end by honoring fathers. So would all the fathers in the room stand up? Whether your father's